Welcome to Crescent City Crime, dear listeners. I'm Tracy.
And I'm Brian.
And thank you to everybody who has been listening to us. Thank you to everybody who's been following us on Instagram, dropping likes on YouTube. Every little bit that you do helps to support us.
Yes, thank you very much. And thank you for getting your enemies involved as well.
Yes, that's right. It's very important that you get your enemies involved.
Yep.
All of our social media links will be in the show notes. So come on by and tell us hello on Facebook, Instagram, follow us on TikTok. And of course, you can always subscribe to us on YouTube.
Yep, it's all free.
It's all free. That's right. It costs nothing to subscribe.
Nothing at all.
So make sure that you are subscribed to us in some way, shape, or form. And if you would like to, ratings and reviews always help us. And we just need to say, though, that this episode will be the last one for January only because we have to still move. We're in the process, but it's going to take a lot of effort between moving and our day jobs.
Yeah,
it's going to be too much to also keep up with the podcast for those couple of weeks. But we will be returning on February the 2nd, and February will be packed full of good content.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, with all that out of the way, Brian, are you ready to talk about the case today?
Ready.
All right. Jeffrey Bucet was born in Port Arthur, Texas in 1959. By his own admission, he was sexually molested as a child. Doucette would also start to molest children. He is classified as a preferential child molester. Preferential child molesters are defined as true pedophiles. They prefer intimate relations with children and have them as subjects of their fantasies. Doucette was a seductive molester. This is the type of person who will usually have a job that allows them access to children, like a teacher or a coach, sometimes both.
Or an extracurricular activity, like Scoutmaster.
That too. These people have interpersonal skills and are good at communicating with children. They will court them with gifts and or attention. These types of molesters select their victims amongst children who are more vulnerable in this situation, like children who receive little affection at home, or maybe they're the product of a single parent household, and that parent, of course, still has to work to support the family, right? So the parent might not be at home a lot.
Yep.
Now, they end their relationships as soon as a child is too old to appeal to them any longer, at which point the molestation is usually reported unless the molester has verbally or physically threatened a child. So some victims stay silent for years.
Mm.
Doucette once had a sexual molestation charge, although it was erased from the records. He relocated to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where he became a karate instructor. At this time, he was living inside his karate school where he coached, and he had no close friends or relationships to talk about. He spent most of his days with children as a karate teacher in Louisiana, and he had the complete trust of all the kids' parents. Doucette spent a lot of time with the kids in and outside of the dojo. He would take his students to the movies, or they would go skating, and sometimes he would take groups of them out of town to compete in karate tournaments.
Yeah, only on Cobra Kai or if you're a molester, I guess.
Wait, what?
Only on Cobra Kai or if you're a molester.
Do you take kids to karate tournaments?
No, I mean, all that stuff put together.
Oh, okay.
Either you're on television or you're, you know, a molester.
Soon, Doucette began to focus on one child in particular, 10-year-old Jody Plache. Doucette was 24 years old when he met Jody in early 1983. Jodie's parents, Gary and June Plauchet, were in the process of divorcing. June described Gary as insanely jealous and possessive, and during this time, she started to invite Jeffrey Doucette around for dinner, and they became intimately involved. Yet, she still felt like Jody was spending too much time with him. Jody stopped playing football and basketball, and all he wanted to do was karate, which, red flag, right?
Yeah, all of a sudden lose interest in other extracurricular activities and only interested in extracurricular activities with
one certain adult.
Yeah.
June's friends said that they could understand how she came to lean on Jeffrey Doucette, especially during this tense separation. They say she felt stifled in her marriage to Gary after she abandoned a budding career as a nightclub singer. To Jody and his brother Mikey, Doucette became something of a father figure, and to Jody, Doucette felt like a best friend. Until Jeffrey Doucette started to test the boundaries with young Jody. He said that Jeff would go, "Oh, we need to stretch." So he would be touching around my legs. That way, if he grabbed my private area, he could say it was an accident. We were just trying to stretch. Jeffrey Doucette also allowed 10-year-old Jody to drive his car, letting Jody sit on his lap while Doucette would also drive the car and his hand would go into Jody's lap.
Yuck.
Yeah. And he'd say, "Oh, I didn't mean to. I didn't realize my hands were there." And that is considered a slow and gradual seduction of a child, where
in Louisiana, it's also sexual battery.
That is sexual battery, you're right. But what they try to do is essentially they get the child used to being touched in a way that they should never be touched by an adult.
Yeah.
Okay. While Jeff was dating June, he sped up the grooming process and the abuse and was planning to kidnap Jody. On February the 19th, 1984, Jeff Doucette told Jody's mother that they were just going for a short drive. But Jeff had asked Jody if he wanted to go to California, and Jody said yes. So Jeff kidnapped him and took him to California.
Mm-mm.
Now, something else to know about Doucette is that he used his students to promote the sale of LSU mugs and Tiger rags to football devotees. He would take the money and promise delivery of the merchandise. When buyers complained about no merchandise showing up, he began dodging creditors and charges of fraud. When Doucette went to California with Jody, he left behind a trail of bad checks. And one store manager claimed that Doucette cashed a $7,500 check made out to a supplier. And this put out a warrant for his arrest for fraud.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
$7,500, yeah. That's grand larceny.
It is grand larceny. And he was afraid that he might not get to see Jody if he went to jail. Just probably one of the motivations behind this kidnapping.
Yeah, yeah.
When Jeffrey Doucette did not return with Jody after several hours, June phoned her brother, a deputy sheriff, and a family friend drove June to Port Arthur. She was going there in an attempt to locate Jody. She had visited the town several times with Jeffrey Doucette. Sometimes they would drop the children off with his relatives in Gonzales, which is about 30 miles south of Baton Rouge.
Yep.
So they could go off dancing in Port Arthur and visit his mother. And Jeff and Jody had been at the family home. his mother told June, but by the time June got there, they were gone.
Huh.
By this time, Jeff Doucette had taken Jody on a bus bound for Los Angeles. Doucette shaved his beard and dyed Jody's blonde hair black and attempted to pass him off as his son. And when they got to Los Angeles, he checked them into a motel where he proceeded to molest and rape Jody Plachet. Now, I shouldn't even have to tell you how frightening this must have been for poor Jody, and also how confusing it must have been.
Yeah, all of a sudden the situation wasn't what he thought it was.
No.
Unfortunately, too young, too naive to understand what was going on.
Now, back in Baton Rouge, the police swung into action. They put a wiretap on June's phone, and they were at the house listening and recording every conversation that came through the phone line. 1 week after Jody vanished, Jeffrey called June. He warned her against telling anyone he called and ordered her to bring the other children and their school transcripts. He told her, "Meet me where they film Hill Street Blues if you want to see Jody again." And she told him, "Gary might use this to get custody of all the children if you don't bring Jody back." And this was a ruse concocted by the police. He said, "If the court gives Gary the kids, I'll get them from him. I'm tired of people saying I'm insane, and if you say I am, you will never hear from me again." Okay. So, yeah. So June played along, and the phone tap traced them to Samoa Motel in Anaheim, California. They even got the room number. It was room number 38. On February the 29th, FBI agents raided the motel and made the arrest. Jody begged to stay with Doucette, but he was examined and flown home. Jeffrey Doucette was indicted for aggravated kidnapping. He waived extradition and phoned a friend to say he was only guilty of bad judgment. "I should have gone back rather than use Jody to pressure June into joining me." But later, outside of the Orange County, California jail, flanked by an FBI agent and two Baton Rouge deputies, Doucette told another story to a family friend of the Plachets. East Baton Rouge Sheriff's Major Mike Barnett was there to escort Doucette back to Baton Rouge. And Jeffrey Doucette told him, "I'm going to tell you all about it." He confessed to everything that he had done to Jody, and he also talked about other children he had harmed in the Baton Rouge area. The lab test done on Jody confirmed what had happened to him and corroborated Jeffrey Doucette's confession. Major Mike Barnett was the one to break the news to Gary and June. And Major Barnett had said that Gary and June had the same reaction most parents do when they find out that their children have been harmed in such a manner. And they were absolutely horrified by it.
Yeah, it's not a surprise that he, when confronted by law enforcement, he professed his, you know, and shared his fascinations with all of this. You know, these people, these you know, criminal molesters with these twisted minds, they always think that they can get someone else to share their fascination with them. You know, it just shows how they're not really in touch with reality.
And back then it was probably more difficult for these people to find each other. Of course, in this day and age, they find each other on the internet.
Yes, it's easier, unfortunately, but that can also make it easier to find them and, you know, and trap them in a sting.
That's very true. And we will continue when we come back after this quick break. and we are back for the rest of the story. In the following days, Gary plotted his revenge. He hung around the airport in an attempt to figure out when Jeffrey Doucet would be coming through back to Baton Rouge. On March 16th, 1984, he saw the Baton Rouge news crew from WBRZ-TV at a bar and heard the remark that Jeffrey would be coming in at 9:08 p.m. This was when Gary Plache went to the airport. He drank a cup of coffee in the restaurant and then moved to the bar where he had a beer. He paced the lobby and he checked flight times. He called his friend Jim Adams from a payphone. He told Jim, "I see them coming. They're coming and they're going to walk right past me. When the camera light comes on, he will be close to me. When I see the light come on the camera, I'm going to shoot him. I'm pulling the gun out of my boot, and you're going to hear the shot." Police walked Doucet in handcuffs through the Baton Rouge airport. Plache stood in a corridor waiting. The tape shows Plache standing at a row of pay telephones as Jeffrey Doucet was walked past him. Gary whipped the gun out and shot Doucet point blank in the head. He allowed himself to be disarmed by Major Mike Barnett, who said, "Why, Gary? Why did you do that?" And Gary Plache replied, "I had to. I had to do it. You know what he did to my son."
Yeah, I saw that. I remember I was the one years ago who showed you that YouTube video.
Yes, you did.
Because I remember hearing about it happening. And I forgot how I stumbled upon it on YouTube. And the video is pretty clear. It's pretty explicit.
It is, but there's no gore.
No, the truth is, if you watch a video of someone being shot, there typically isn't going to be any gore. It's not like watching it in a TV show or a movie.
Well, I will link the video clip in the show notes. Jeffrey Doucet crumbled to the ground, and there was blood pooling around his head, and he slipped into a coma, and he died the next day.
Yeah, all's well that ends well.
And the court of public opinion agreed with you. Gary Plache was a hero. The bartender who waited on Gary that night, her name is Linda Boyd. She said, "I would have shot him if he would have hurt my boys. Except I would have shot him 3 or 4 times in the gut so he would suffer first."
Yeah, it's if you get shot in the gut, that's all intestinal wounds. And, you know, when the intestinal fluids mix with
the blood.
Mix with the blood, it's very painful. And it's a slow death.
Well, that's sepsis.
Yeah.
You become septic when it happens. So, parents who had students in Doucet's classes contacted the prosecutor to say that they removed their kids from the class because their children were acting strangely, and they believed that Jeffrey Doucet was the problem.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. Yeah, your teacher's a child molester. The behavior is. Behavior is going to be odd occasionally.
Yeah, it is.
Although they can be pretty good at hiding it overall.
They can be.
They're going to be very friendly with the kids and all that stuff. And that's one thing. It's in retrospect, people might say, "Oh, he was good with kids."
That's true, but I also feel like that if that is your true nature. I don't know how else to describe this. No matter how carefully you try to conceal it, things leak out. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, there's certain things that betray the behavior.
Yes. The people who supported Gary were very vocal about it, and it seemed like what he did was perfectly justifiable in the eyes of many. Gary spent just a weekend in jail. A judge later ruled him no threat to the community and gave him 5 years probation, 7 years on a suspended sentence, and 300 hours of community service. Now, vigilante justice is a slippery slope. I know that many parents, and I'm especially sure that of those who are in our audience, might feel like this was justified. I'm not even a parent, and a part of me feels like that this is justified.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be able to stop myself in the same situation like in my case, like if it's a niece or nephew, I don't think I'd be able to stop myself. I would be compelled, and I would be thinking about it all the time until the matter is settled.
Right. But Jeffrey Doucette would never get to go to court and be convicted in the eyes of the law. And if he had other victims, they would not get to testify against him. Now, I just want everybody to think about how much planning this took. This was a premeditated murder.
Yes, that is quite true, and that's also why this is one of those instances of vigilante justice where the guilty party is targeted. There's no mistakes made. It's because he was methodical and carefully planned it.
Right. But, you know, just remember, everybody, vigilante justice is a slippery slope. I don't want to ever really encourage it, although I can understand it.
It's not legal because it's quite possible you can get the wrong person and get the wrong house.
You could get the wrong person, but you could also perhaps give in to your own darker demons and do something worse than just shoot somebody. Like if you go into a prolonged torture against somebody else, that might not be the best thing.
Well, not the best thing for you, you know, because then you're subjecting yourself to the situation.
But also if you get caught, that's going to be a lot of charges against you.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, you can see it from both sides, of course, but there's another perspective that needs to be introduced, and that is Jody's. He said, "I think one of the things people really don't understand is why I did not tell." He said, "One, I was 10 years old. Two, what was happening I knew would upset my parents. And three, at the time, I didn't want Jeffrey Doucette to get in trouble. It was easier for me to keep quiet and shut up than to upset everybody." Which, again, goes back to the confusion of somebody being victimized in this way.
Yeah.
Okay, it's not always about just the physical things that happen. It's also the mental stress that a victim goes through. In the aftermath of Jeffrey Doucette's death, Jody Poche struggled to forgive his father for what he had done. He says, "After the shooting happened, I was very upset with what my father did. I did not want Jeff killed. I felt like he was going to go to jail, and that was enough for me." He also said that he felt afraid that his dad would go to jail at a time when he would have needed him the most.
Which is a very reasonable fear.
It is. But he was eventually able to forgive his father, and they remained close until Gary's death in 2014, when he passed away after having a stroke. Jody attended Louisiana State University and started a lifelong career in activism. At LSU, he served on the executive board for Men Against Violence, and upon graduation, he began work at the Victim Services Center of Montgomery County as a sexual assault counselor. And as an adult, Jody has also spoken out about how parents can protect their children from abusers like Jeffrey Doucette. He says, "If someone wants to spend more time with your kids than you do, that's a red flag." And in 2019, he released a book called Why, Gary, Why? which aims to help parents identify if someone is taking advantage of their child. And that's the case of Gary Poche and how he got away with first-degree murder against a vile human being.
Well, he served probation. He didn't.
That's getting away with it.
He didn't completely get away with it. That's a felony conviction.
Yeah, probation's still a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, it's a felony conviction. He's not eligible to own a firearm.
And well, that's true.
The worst thing about it, in actuality, was that he traumatized himself when he shot another person in the head.
That he did.
Okay. That's actually the worst part of it. Okay. A dirty, filthy, stinking child molester getting what he so richly deserves. That's not such a bad thing.
No.
Now, of course, we can't recommend this form of justice. Because quite simply, you are subjecting yourself to legal danger and subjecting yourself to the trauma,
right,
of committing this heinous action with a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, quite frankly, most people, when they handle firearms, they're quite simply, you know, putting it in a holster, putting it in a drawer, okay, or a case, or putting it in a safe, just taking it to the shooting range. And, you know, when you're target practicing in the shooting range, you're not even thinking about shooting somebody. You're just simply shooting this target. You're putting a hole through paper. And, you know, it's an experience that relieves stress, kind of like exercise, and it's fun, especially if you train and you take your classes and you do it properly. You know, you build your skills up. But, you know, shooting a person is an entirely different thing. It's not actually easy to shoot a person.
No, I feel like Gary probably had to psych himself up to do it.
Yes, you do. But the most important thing Gary had to do was he had to dehumanize this child molester. He had to devalue his life.
Which I would argue is quite easy to do. And everybody
in that situation, yes,
but everybody in this world has done it on some level. Maybe you didn't actually go out and shoot somebody, but if you read something in the news, you might think, well, that person had it coming.
Right. And see, it's easy to read about this, you know, this vigilante justice in the news and think of, well, he had it coming, which he did. But it's easier to do that than it is to actually to do this yourself.
Right.
Because naturally, you know, human beings naturally don't like killing each other. They have to psych themselves up to do it. And devalue the other person.
Exactly. Yes. Now, do you have any more discussion or final thoughts to add?
Well, it's simply best to stay out of trouble.
It is simply best to stay out of trouble.
But in that situation, in the situation of Gary Poche, it takes more to stop yourself from doing such a thing than it does to actually commit this action.
Right. Yes, I am of two minds about it. I feel like Jeffrey Doucette got what he deserved, but I also feel like, you know, if you're a parent, and if you want to do something like this, you need to consider the aftermath. Will you actually be able to be there for your children if you do such a thing?
Yeah. Oh, another thing, will you be able to live with this action for the rest of your life? Because that's what you're going to have to do.
Yeah, that too. Now, Gary, just because Gary's sentence was so light does not necessarily mean that if another person were to do this, that their sets would be as light.
Yes, yes. That's a classic situation of, oh, this person got this stiff sentence for this crime, but this person got a light sentence for that crime. No two cases are identical.
No two cases are identical.
Yeah, that's what you have to remember, people. Sentences for the same crime are going to be different because the cases are different. Circumstances are different. You know, that's what the sentencing phase is all about. The evaluation of the circumstances of this particular case, and the circumstances of different cases are going to be different even for the same kind of crime.
And you could have, you might also only, now Gary Poche had a private attorney, okay? And his attorney immediately sent him to a mental ward in the immediate aftermath of this murder, okay? Now, if you're working with, say, a public defender or maybe an attorney who does not cost as much money as this one did, you could be in an entirely different situation.
Yeah, that's another factor. The attorneys are going to be different.
And you could also get a prosecutor who is determined to make a name for themselves off your case.
Oh yeah, quite true. And that's going to be a prosecutor who is not going to care about the circumstances and might not even care whether or not you were justified.
Right.
There was this case of this woman who she fired upon an estranged boyfriend whom she had a restraining order against. He basically kicks her door in and enters. And so she doesn't shoot him. What she does is she fires warning shots into the ceiling, and he runs away. And so the police ask her what she did, and instead of telling the police that she feared for her life and that she fired at him and unfortunately missed, she told the police she fired warning shots, which are illegal.
Oh, wow.
Because warning shots can cause property damage.
Oh, no, not the poor property.
And hit innocent bystanders.
Now, that's the part. Okay,
that's why warning shots are illegal. Yes.
But, I mean, if there's nobody living above you and you fire a couple of rounds into the ceiling, it's...
So, the prosecutor didn't care.
Right.
The prosecutor went after her for that. Prosecuted her for that. And this lady actually did serve some time in jail until she was granted clemency by the governor of Florida.
Well, thank goodness for... Oh, wait. Was that governor was not DeSantis, was it?
No, it wasn't DeSantis.
Okay, then thank goodness that whatever governor that was...
Although DeSantis would have done the same thing, very likely, you know, being pro Second Amendment.
Maybe.
Like probably his only saving grace.
Well, maybe if the woman was white, but I don't know, if she would have been a woman of color, probably not.
I'm not so sure.
Nah.
Who's it? Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey.
Former governor
of New Jersey. He pardoned a black nuclear engineer who had been wrongfully jailed by the New Jersey State Police because he had a handgun in his glove box. And he had just moved there from Virginia. The gun was legally owned. And he unfortunately consented to a search of the vehicle, and it was in the glove box. And so the usual, you know, anti-gun New Jersey State Police threw the book at him. Quite possibly because he was, you know, owning a firearm while black.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no arrest record. Man's a nuclear engineer. And you're going to throw him in jail for something as petty as having a legal handgun in the glove box. So, I mean, you know, sometimes these Republican governors will do the right thing. In that case, Chris Christie did.
Yeah, even a sob clock is right twice a day.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, is that all you have to say today? Or is that all we have to say? Are we done?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, dear listeners, thank you so much for spending some time with us this week. Again, we will be back on February the 2nd. That is Groundhog's Day. Hey, maybe we'll just keep repeating ourselves on the Groundhog's Day. All right, so maybe on the Groundhog's Day episode, we'll just repeat every word twice. What do you think?
I think we'll... Yeah, we'll do that. No, I'll bark like a dog.
Yes, that was our dog making a guest appearance just because she decided that the other dog was doing something she did not especially care for.
Yeah, she's our Paw Patrol.
Our Paw Patrol. But we love that dog. We love all of our dogs.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
We love our Luna.
Yeah.
Nicknamed Looney Tunes. Which y'all just heard why she's nicknamed Looney Tunes.
Maybe I should put a picture up on Instagram of her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I should. So in that way, everybody can see the picture of the offended dog.
Offending dog, yeah.
The offending dog, that's it. Yes. All right, everybody. Be safe, be kind. Remember that we're all human beings, and love your dogs because they love you.
Yeah, remember, if it's dark, it doesn't feel safe, and you don't feel safe, looks dangerous, don't be there in the first place. And if you are talking to law enforcement in an official capacity, and you're not the victim or the witness to a crime, lawyer up.